And good morning, everybody, in ACIM Gather. You have Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson, and we're here this week to read. Even though I just got off a call with this incredible lesson of the day, I'm not going to go into that. We're going to read the book that we're here for, The Journey Home by Dr. Kenneth Wapnick. And it is a discussion of the obstacles to peace from A Course in Miracles. It's in chapter 19 of A Course in Miracles. If you have it and you want to check it out, read along with us. Of course, we're not reading directly from the book. From the Course in Miracles, we're reading from Ken Wapnick's discussion of the book. But there is...
Text listing, right?
Yes. It's just so amazing. So anyway, it's A Journey Home, Dr. Kenneth Wapnick. And good morning, Bruce. How are you this morning, and what's going on with you?
I'm fine, thanks. And just eager to dive in where we left off, because I always enjoy this conversation so much.
You, me too. In
the- I mean, I, there's plenty of trivia in my dream world that I could share, but none of them particularly interesting. Oh, there is one thing. I think I might have mentioned this last week, is... Doug Sparks is a wonderful course teacher, and in my mind, you know, the closest thing to Ken Wapnick is in terms of someone walking the earth with Ken's both head, heart, and spirit. Anyway, I can't say enough good things about Doug. He's doing a workshop in Mexico this next month, in September the 20th. I could probably look it up. Anyways, in the 20s, as far as days of the month.
I think it is the 20th, actually. I'm not sure.
Yeah. It's in September in Axochitl, Mexico, near Lake Chapala. And Doug's going to conduct this four-day workshop there. And the details are on his site at DougSparksACIM.com. And if anybody has the least inclination, by all means, check it out. And you know, while you're there, you might as well subscribe, even if you're not going to Mexico, and enjoy Doug's insights and wit and humor and wisdom. So, good stuff.
Very good. And, boy, I'd love to go to Mexico right now. That's awesome.
Yeah, I've attended a number of his workshops over the years, and they're just wonderful. I mean, I first – in fact, I think I heard the one called The Garden Epiphany. That was either that one or one that I just put up on there. It was like 2012, something like that, when I'd first moved to Colorado. I learned about the Rocky Mountain Miracle Center, and so I thought I'd go check it out, and that was one of the first things I heard there, and Doug just gave a wonderful workshop, and ever since, it's like, oh my gosh, he really, really has, you can, like, the spirit of Ken, you know, I mean, he really studied with Ken from the get-go, and so in the late 70s, he really, you know, jumped onto the course and quickly decided that Ken was his gold standard and stuck with that, and it really shows in the quality and the clarity of what he shares, and also the fun and the humor and the heart that he conveys as well. So,
oh yeah, and I was looking at some of those. I did hop onto your website, which is acimblog.com, and checked out, you know, some of the recordings that you have, and you know, I'm learning a lot from you about, you know, people in the course community, because I really don't, even though I've been around a while and have met up with a bunch of people, this is, you know, kind of what I was saying, I think, last week, was that there seem to be, like, little disparate groups of people who are studying A Course in Miracles, and they all have, like, their own little cult. I don't want to call it a cult, but, you know, a little clique. When I see people, like, because I know James Twyman, Jimmy Twyman, and you know, the group of people that he kind of hangs with, were with the Endeavor Academy, and were following the Charles Anderson, the master teacher, and you know, there for a long time. I was kind of the opinion that they were heretics, because because, you know, I had a lot of personal opinions about things. You know how that goes. You know, as I got to know them, I saw, well, geez, you know, these are just as sincere as people in the world who are loving A Course in Miracles. And so, you know, this perceived argument that I thought was going on between the Foundation for Inner Peace and the Endeavor Academy and, you know, all these other little groups that were arguing about nothing.
I mean, the People's Front of Judea and the Judea People's Front raises its head again.
Exactly. And, I've seen over the years, many just really ridiculous arguments and fights going on between Course in Miracles students about the minutiae of the Course that completely forget the truth and reality of what the teaching is, which is equality and love and,
inclusion.
Total inclusion. Yeah.
The irony is not lost on us.
No. Yeah. It's hilarious. It's exciting to me to know, okay, here's somebody who is a Ken Wapnick, devotee, for lack of a better word. I know that's not really. But who is, joining with these others, and there are a lot of other people that are joining together in these ways and that are coming together and recognizing that the things that came between us had no meaning, and that our thoughts and beliefs about, the origin of the Course, the way the Course should be written, what chapter should be which, and what should be left in and what should be taken out, and all those arguments that really we're just throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Because if you even understood the first miracle principle, you would absolutely know that that's all complete BS and has no meaning. We Course in Miracles students take on to, save the world in our own particular way. What I'm trying to say is, I'm so glad and grateful to see that there is a joining and a coming together and a recognition that the thoughts that we had that we were separate were wrong, and it was just a mistake, and that I'm not being disloyal to you to go to a conference with, Doug Sparks, if I, think that, Charles Anderson is the greatest teacher in the world. I'm not being disloyal to read Ken's books. I'm not being disloyal to read anybody's books about Course in Miracles. And, really everyone is, we're all the same.
Yeah, and I think that irony that the only thing that A Course in Miracles suggests, it doesn't demand, it doesn't insist, it just basically suggests you'll be happier if you include everyone in your assessment of self and identity. And from that perspective, the idea of differences, an order of difficulty, or just any orders even, the whole notion of duality just disintegrates in our mind, and as today, well, I know you've talked about today's work with us, but I think it's a particularly good one. The only thing we really need to rule is the kingdom of our mind that has gotten into this duality kick and made a really big deal out of nothing, and we just need to look at that with the teacher of sameness. It leads us back to the oneness, but the sameness really is really our gateway back to, the shared interest is the gateway back to that place in the mind where we can just gently laugh at that whole idea and the absurdity that differences mean anything in truth. And on a level of form, sure, but a big difference, if I, stand in the middle of the ocean, compared to standing on the floor in the room that I'm in, I'm going to need to, exhibit different behaviors in order to survive.
You'll have a different experience, but you know what? You just made me think of something. Jesus didn't have that experience. Now, Jesus could walk on water. So
Well, okay, I wasn't going to go there, but you know, the historical figure that may or may not have had anything to do with the author of A Course in Miracles, but you know, we sort of the default assumption is probably, but who knows? It's really the whole point is that if I'm not a body, I'm free. I'm still as God created. If there's any truth to that, then that historical figure is just as irrelevant as, in truth, as the historical figure of Bruce and Lynn, or Gary Renard and his teachers, Artin and Persa, or Ken Wapnick, or any right. any person, or any specific thing, whether it's a galaxy or an atom, a quasar, it's like there's none of this has any bearing on the truth, which is beyond space and time, that is our real identity, and that we all share, and that's again why it just is, not in any kind of mean-spirited or derisive way, but just laughable to think that all these things are just such cosmically, refined distractions that we've elaborated and turned into this incredibly complex, sophisticated, photorealistic game that we play 24/7, and we never question the game. We never do like Captain Kirk and the Kobayashi Maru scenario at Starfleet, where he says, "Well, I'm just going to rewrite the program here. I this is a no-win scenario."
Exactly. Well, you know what, though? The reason I brought up about the walking on water is because that is a perfect lesson for us to recognize that he did not follow the same rules of physics that appeared.
Different drummer.
Yeah, he could walk through walls. He could walk on water. He died and came back to life. Those are all lessons or symbols to us to teach us about, the truth about what we are. And I do believe, because he does say, I do have to, even though I know we don't, well, let me just back up. It's all a dream, right? It's all a dream. It's a story.
Right.
So there really was never any Jesus. There's really no Bruce. There's really no Lynn. None of that ever actually occurred. But in the story, the way the story is written, here was a character, and he says it in the clarification of terms, he was a man who saw that everyone around him was Christ, and he remembered God. But he does, mention the other, some things that we consider miraculous, and he explains it to us in that section where he says, the man was an illusion.
Yes.
As all are. And the man, the man could actually do these things because that was the part of the illusion the man did. To show us that water does stop us. Air doesn't.
Yeah.
None of those
and,
things.
And the us that it doesn't stop is the decision-making faculty in the mind, which is the only goal in A Course in Miracles is to get us to return back to that point and throw the switch at some point, once and for all, away from the ego setting, which is its normal default in this world, to the Holy Spirit's forgiveness setting. And if we do that enough, with enough practice, with enough consistency over time, we discover, I really do feel better. I'm more at peace. I'm not really as upset or concerned about the outcomes of things that happen or don't happen in the world, whether I'm standing on the ocean and with or without, a belief system that supports me, standing without, dropping down another 6 or 7 feet kind of all of a sudden, that's kind of irrelevant. That's kind of a moot point, because the peace that is being spoken about, that is the end product or the result of successful completion of A Course in Miracles, is really the thing that transcends the world altogether. And at that point, we won't really be caring about what's happening in the world. Ironically, however, of course, is because of our belief systems, we need, or appear to need, a path that minimizes the fear in both our seeming separate selves and those of others. And so in order to achieve that, oftentimes it takes the form of doing things that minimize the fear And I think that's why Gary Renard and a lot of his writing, you know, with Art and Person suggestions. So like the third book, I guess it was, or some second, I think it was, I can't remember. I need to reread those. He talks about, you know, some practical things to do in the world and certain health regimens and dietary things and you know, stuff like that. It's like, and then Cindy Laura Renard's book has, which I need to get a copy of it because I know it's got good stuff like that in there too. You know, those things can be really helpful because if you aren't concerned about, you know, imminent collapse of your body's functioning and so forth, you know, you're probably going to be more inclined to spend a little more time during the day, you know, reflecting on today's workbook lesson or just, you know, being more peaceful in general because, you know, that stuff is out of the way. Not because that's a requirement, but just because of the nature of, you know, the system that we set up. Why not give the ego dog a bone to chew while our mind is off, you know, really practicing the course? And I think that's a really helpful thing. And it kind of ties in with the early admonition in the text that says, you know, it's a particularly unworthy form of denial to deny your physical experience because, again, the physical experience is exactly what we need to look at in our mind as, you know, whenever there's the least little bit of limiting thinking or upset involved in reflecting upon what our sensory data brings to our back to our mind and the ego's interpretation of it. We can just look at those interpretations and say, how interesting. the ego is painting a picture here that makes this abstract, totally neutral data into something that's either good or bad, as Shakespeare would say. And it really only has the meaning that we give it, like those early workbook lessons suggested.
I know those early workbook lessons are like so profound.
Yeah, they go right to the heart of it. Just step one, and at the same time, presented in a way that is like, oh, I could try this. You know, even if you have zero experience in any kind of metaphysical system or you know spiritual philosophical inquiry, it's like, wow, that's you know that's pretty universally presented. So the brilliance and the genius of the course is still amazing when you think about it, isn't it?
It is amazing, and you could go through your whole life doing that, looking at everything and saying, you know, that thing has no meaning, and the only meaning it has is the meaning I give to it, and then really look at what meanings you're given to things. It's pretty amazing. It's, you know, not just one or two days a year. If you did that every day, you would very soon see, you know, how real clearly that, you know, I'm making it all up. Or that's been my experience anyway. And perfect what you're saying there, Bruce. The thing about the body and the health, you know, you can be in denial all you want about your, you know, how much you believe that. But I can guarantee you, if you went for a day or two without a cup of coffee or a glass of water or, you know, something to eat or, you know, like this morning so far, I've had half a banana, I've had, you know, half a cup of tea, I've had some allergy medicine, you know, I didn't even think about it. You know, I didn't think in looking at this stuff and saying, well, you know, this really doesn't mean anything except for the purpose I've given it. You know, it might shift things for me if I was doing that. And I might not.
And it's a gradual exercise in being more and more mindful, not in any kind of, you know, Nazi Gestapo-like, we have this to make you mindful. It's not about this. It's like voluntarily, gently, willingly looking at everything with a suffused kindness where it's like, oh, yeah, anytime I happen to notice anything that has the slightest irritation or upset, or a little on the big stuff that, you know, where we fly off the handle and get really angry, it just says, it's never justified. It just doesn't mean that you won't. It just means that whenever you can look at those things and the least little condemnation or judgment or assessment of anyone as being less than all of spirit, that's a clue. It's saying, oh, I'm labeling this package that appears to be, you know, a person in a body, and I'm limiting the mind and the spirit of this brother that really is in truth identical to my own identity by thinking that, you know, this person's story and history and you know, particular travel, you know, through the dream drama of life is somehow different or better or worse than anything else. And, you know, all those kind of thoughts are just, they're just silly ultimately. And if we can just kind of look at that way and just say, oh, well, there we go again. No big deal. I can drop it, you know, just like training a dog to drop the stick so that you can throw it again.
Exactly, exactly. And speaking of dropping the stick, my gosh. Let's go look at our book.
Let's do that. Yeah, you know, it's fun because we tend to spend usually the first half hour at least just kind of rapping and riffing and having fun. And but, you know, I have at least as much fun reading and talking about the writing,
oh, yeah,
too. So
let's for dive. Sure, me sure. too. And you know, it's just good to get Ken into the conversation, I think.
Yeah.
I like
yeah.
that. So I bookmarked where we were last time, but I'm thinking, let's see, because I was at where we were at, what did that just say? Be not afraid of them, they offer you salvation. I think we need to go back a couple paragraphs and read the Forgiven World. What do you think about that?
Oh, sure. Want me to do that?
Sure.
Okay.
And while you're doing that,
this
I'm going to
chapter 17 in the text.
Make sure the recorder's recording right. So.
Okay.
You read.
All right. It says, can you imagine how beautiful those you forgive will look to you? In no fantasy have you ever seen anything so lovely. Nothing you see here, sleeping or waking, comes near to such loveliness. And nothing will you value like unto this, nor hold so dear. Nothing that you remember that made your heart sing with joy has ever brought you even a little part of the happiness this sight will bring you. For you will see the Son of God. You will behold the beauty the Holy Spirit loves to look upon, and which he thanks the Father for. He was created to see this for you until you learn to see it for yourself. And all his teaching leads to seeing it and giving thanks with him. This loveliness is not a fantasy. It is the real world, bright and clean and new, with everything sparkling under the open sun. Nothing is hidden here, for everything has been forgiven, and there are no fantasies to hide the truth. The bridge between that world and this is so little and so easy to cross that you could not believe it is the meeting place of worlds so different. Yet this little bridge is the strongest thing that touches on this world at all. This little step, so small it has escaped your notice, is a stride through time and into eternity, beyond all ugliness into beauty that will enchant you and will never cease to cause you wonderment at its perfection. Yeah, this is one of those lovely, lovely passages, of course, that just kind of hints at what happens when we subtract the ego's misinformation, you know, moment by moment, and as a result accumulate an awareness and an appreciation of the real beauty, the real loveliness, as it describes here, of the self that we all share. And we just get a little glimpses of it most of the time because, you know, we have such an enormous resistance to the not invented here, not in my mind's backyard. I'm not quite ready for Holy Spirit's peace that makes this world obsolete in the thinking. And so, you know, we just need to be gentle with ourselves until we have enough awareness of the peace that really does sustain us, and that love that is beyond anything we can imagine in the world, and in its instability and its impermanence. You know, once we get a glimpse of the permanent, stable, real peace and loving kindness that is in the self that we all share with capital S, we're not going to go back. And I think we're in that process of, we've already kind of passed the point of no return. I think anyone listening to this is probably already, you know, nodding and thinking to themselves, yeah, I can't go back to ego stuff. It's just, it never worked and never will. So really the only way forward is through it, and through looking at the ego with the Holy Spirit and just watching it disintegrate, watching that false assessment, that misunderstanding, vaporize with the light of the Holy Spirit's understanding, which is all about shared interest and seeing that everyone in our world is our teacher and the face of Christ that is presented to us moment to moment if we just allow ourselves to see that.
Yeah, well, that's beautiful. And that what you just read comes from a section of the course called The Forgiven World. Mm-hmm. And, the idea that this is what you will see when you have forgiven the world, when you have forgiven all of your dreams, all of your thoughts, all of your beliefs, everything that you've put on the world, when you have forgiven all of that, the world that you're going to see is a world that is just totally peaceful. And, the yogis talk about this, gurus and such, you go into this bliss and I read a lot of Nisargadatta Maharaj. He's like my guru. It's weird because I never met the man, but everything I read from him, just the vibe from him is just so compelling to me. Mm-hmm. Because I believe that he did come into this. He was existing in a world. He described how he was seeing the world, and it was not like you and I see it in any way at all. Because this is something that is available to every single one of us. Mm-hmm. All the time. And, what we're reading about, the obstacles to peace, really are the things that are preventing us from being in this world. And one of them is, I don't know what I'm going to do if that happens.
And we think there's something we need to do. That's the, part of the problem is thinking that A, we'll somehow, be not up to the task, and B, we won't know what our identity is, and I think that's why one of the more challenging passages in the course is, it says something like, the most difficult thing in the world is to say, I don't know who I am and what I'm here for, and I'm paraphrasing greatly, but
yes.
I can recall that.
It's the thing that ego does not want to hear.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And because, that basically calls onto the carpet the whole, mistake that is just—it's just a simple error. It's not a sin, or it's not evil. It's not wicked, as Ken points out. And a moment ago, when you were talking about the yogis, I was thinking, well, those are the two thought systems, and we have the yogi thought system and the boo boo thought system. It's just a little—it's a mistake, right?
Oh, you!
For those of you who didn't grow up with that particular Hanna-Barbera cartoon, please forgive, and you can Google it, right?
Oh my gosh, Yogi and Boo Boo, that's hilarious. Well, there we go, and I'm sure they didn't think about that, but that's how everything is arranged in a way that when you look back on it, you see how things came about. You see how perfectly the confluence of everything has been, and even Yogi and Boo Boo, that happened for a moment that we can share. That happened for this moment now, whether you recognize it or not.
Exactly.
Thank you. This is just so lovely. I just posted in the room the section from The Forgiven World that we just read. Because, what I was saying before about how, if the one of the main things that stops me from really longing for this is that I think I have something to do in this world. Well, that's what the forgiving is. The forgiving is, coming to the recognition that there's nothing that I need to do, and that, I'm not responsible for the world, the dream, the story, or any part of it, even my own body, my children, my husband, my garden. I'm not responsible for those things. I've grown up my whole life, and I'm sure you have too, I know you do, to feel that I'm responsible. and that I have to do something, and if I don't do it and I don't do it right, something is going to go wrong. And so the idea somehow that I could suddenly become irresponsible, you know, that I could suddenly, you know, not see all the fearful things in the world that need to be fixed, you know, that I could just go through life seeing nothing but peace and joy, while, you know, obviously other people are still suffering. You know, that's the thing but what I just said was exactly the oxymoron. That whole idea that other people are suffering is the problem.
It is, yeah. And what you were just saying a moment ago, you know, reminded me of a short speech that Jim Carrey gave at the Golden Globe Awards a few years ago, and I thought it was brilliant. So I somehow it flashed on my mind when I was talking to a friend the other evening. So I found the link there, and I just put it in the chat there. But anyway, where he talks about he comes up to the podium, you know, dressed in his tuxedo and finery and so forth, and he says, he's, you know, introduces, here comes, you know, now two-time Golden Globe winner, Jim Carrey, and he walks up to the podium and says, yes, that's right, I'm two-time award winner Jim Carrey, and I lay awake at nights wondering when I'm going to become three-time award winner Jim Carrey, and when that will ever be enough, you know. And but he just did it brilliantly, and was simultaneously lampooning, you know, in a gentle way, the whole idea of award ceremonies and you know, making a big deal out of specialness and separation. At the same time, you know, kind of, you know, kindly appreciating and enjoying, you know, the attention that had been lavished on him and so forth. But it was just, I thought it was hilarious and also very insightful and fun. And so if you haven't seen it, I highly encourage you. Just Google Jim Carrey Enough Golden Globe and you'll find it really quickly.
I just posted it in the room so people
can... Yeah, it's a fun one. So.
But
the ego is never enough.
Yeah.
I mean, and also, speaking of enough, if you go to sfacim.org, and look for the YouTube channel. I also posted on aciblog.com some of the recent conversations with Tim Wise and Lynn Corona, and one of them, I'm not sure if I put, well, if I haven't posted it, I will very soon, but there's one of the conversations, the talks that Tim gave that I thought was particularly brilliant about enough, and it kind of reminded me of this, actually, the Jim Carrey. That, you know, he talks about how, you know, the ego never has enough because the ego is based on the idea of division, separation, the something that's not self, the duality of other, of consciousness itself, which is has to be aware of something not itself. And so that self, no matter how you slice or dice it, is never enough. Even if it's, you know, galactic size, you know, or whatever, pan-galactic. You know. But the self that we really are, the capital S self, that's all-inclusive, that, of course, Miracles is leading us back to and leading us to the threshold of, is with this forgiveness curriculum, is really always enough, because it's always returning us to the mind, the place in the mind, where we can choose the enoughness of everything.
Exactly.
How could everything not be enough?
Exactly.
Except in a mad illusion, a mad dream.
Two points that came up while you were talking there, and I did put the link in. That's a school for A Course in Miracles. Very nice. I just looked at the website. The one thing I was thinking when you were saying that is that more is the, Dove often talks about this, the Antichrist. When Jesus talks about the Antichrist in A Course in Miracles, it is the concept really of more, that what I have is not enough. Right. And so that was...
It's also the Uncle Christ.
Yeah, it's the Antichrist. But it's not
because,
the return of God.
If you make it relative, then it's not the whole, right?
It's not the whole. Oh, you cracked me up. Okay, it is all relative. So that was something that I was thinking about, and then I also thought about just this week, and you know, bringing in timely news. One of the Koch brothers passed away David Cook died. And if you don't know who that is, probably your life is surrounded by everything that he's made. They're billionaires, and they invested money and built a lot of things, these two brothers. They're very conservative and pretty much right-wing. There were some things, you know, that they supported that were independent or whatever the third party is. Anyway, I have often thought about those two brothers and, well, anybody else, anybody who just wants more money, more money, more money, more money, just to see the number go up. It has baffled me. It's always baffled me, you know, how people could, you know, be that way or think that way. He passed away and everybody's like, well, he couldn't take it with him anyway, ha ha ha. And I was thinking, yeah, you know what? That is, you know, that's true. But he also learned that was not going to fulfill him either. And, you know, I'm the same way. I want more. You know, I always, the people who here doesn't want more. You want more ice cream? You want more money?
More or less of something is always the ego's mantra, right?
That's right. That's more or less of something. And so just the whole idea that there can be more than this, more than, you know, reality, is ego's, I mean, that's ego's big ploy, isn't it? The very first tiny man idea is, could there be more? You know, I mean, seriously, I don't even know what it really was, but I think could there be more is a good description of it.
Let's think of a hypothetical example. Let's take perfect one that's shattered into countless pieces and identify with one of those tiny infinitesimal pieces and then block out the memory of that imaginary process from our mind, compartmentalize our minds into such a bizarre, absurd, unimaginable state that where we believe that we're not aware of those other pieces, or at least most of them, the vast majority of them on a galactic scale, and then we're astonished to discover that there's more than we imagined, and also that it seems to be unattainable to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, and even though it's just a dream of Humpty falling off the wall.
Exactly. Yeah. But the whole idea right now isn't this desire to have everything, is the desire to have everything. It's what we are. We want to have everything.
Sure.
I don't want to be separated from anything at all. And, you know, in our minds we think, well, having it is it having it in my house. But having it is having it, joining together in one wholeness, we have everything. There's nothing missing. You know, shalom, you know, nothing missing, nothing broken. It's all perfect. That's what we actually have, and that's what we were just reading from the Forgiven World, is that, you know, when we recognize that we have everything, and there's no more, because everything is here, all-inclusive, everything. There is no more than that. You know, I truly think now that I'm thinking about it, that must have been what that tiny man idea was. Could there be more? And
or less.
Or less.
More or less.
Yeah. No, I think it had to be a desire for more, a desire for variety, a desire for entertainment, a desire for the sensation of physicality, the desire, you know, whatever it is, I don't know. It's kind of creepy when you think about it, you know, because we wished it all here, and it's all that's happening. anyway, let's go on to our book here. It says, "Be not afraid of them; they offer you salvation." This is a line that is often repeated in A Course in Miracles in different ways, and is taken from the famous scriptural phrase, "Be not afraid," quote, "Be not afraid," from Matthew 28. Remember, the ego has taught us that we should be afraid, and recall again that the first line of this section states, the attraction of guilt produces fear of love. The ego has convinced us that if we look with love at the world, we will be undone. Wow, the ego has convinced us that if we look at the world with love, we will be undone. Yet Jesus is teaching us that the ego that it is the ego that is undone by love, and that we are not the ego. We simply believe that we are. And here's another quote from A Course in Miracles. As you approach the beginning, in brackets, i.e. God, you feel the fear of the destruction of your thought system upon you as if it were the fear of death. There is no death, but there is a belief in death. You who fear salvation are choosing death. Well, isn't that just what we were just now talking about? Was this fear of what we, this choosing of the world because we fear that we'll be destroyed. And what'll I do then? How will things go on without me? You know, just the whole idea. Oh my gosh. Earlier in the text, Jesus describes the ego's response to our learning the Holy Spirit's lessons instead of its own, accepting his evaluation of us in place of the ego's. And here's another quote from A Course in Miracles. You then have two conflicting evaluations of yourself in your mind, and they cannot both be true. You do not yet realize how completely different these evaluations are, because you do not understand how lofty the Holy Spirit's perception of you really is. It's interesting that he says it like that. You do not see how understand how lofty the Holy Spirit's perception of you really is. Do you ever think about how the Holy Spirit thinks about you?
Once in a while, yeah. I think whenever I remember to not see the people in my world as being less than or part of Spirit, then I have that same assessment of myself, and I think that's what taps us into that awareness, that recognition that, you know, we really can afford to look on everyone with lovingness, you know, loving kindness and forgiveness, because that's how we see ourselves. Because there is just no, there's nobody out there.
There's nobody out there. However
I see the world is how I see myself.
Yeah.
Every seemingly separate self in it.
And that's a great point. And actually, you know, quite, you know, useful. Right?
Oh, very, very. Yeah.
Because
it's a very pragmatic course, because peace is not a little gift. Right?
Exactly. Well, and you know what you just pointed out, that, you know, may seem kind of subtle there, but what you just pointed out is that my perception of you is what's going to reflect into my perception of myself, mm-hmm. and my understanding of myself. So if I'm seeing you with love, then I can only perceive that I am seen with love. You know, I can't see you with love and see myself as being an evil sinner or a bad person. You know, you think you might be able to do that, but it's not true. What maybe you are seeing with other people may be a love of kind of a special love that is not a love for the truth of what you are. It's a love for the picture that we see and the story that we have about the picture. You know, that's what love in the world is pretty much all about. This is a different kind of love that has nothing to do with the story or the picture. And so to look at our brothers without the story and the picture, whomever it is, that is real love and real joining. And when we can do that and see the innocence that they are, that's what's been kind of overwhelming me lately, is looking at these people, these beings that I have, you know, thought were, you know, bad and evil, and just looking at them and recognizing how innocent they are, and, you know, how confused they are and how afraid they are, and how my attack on them, making them more confused and and angry, is not helping. And, you know, really the only thing that I can do to, you know, if I'm not liking how a person is acting or what I'm hearing or seeing, the only thing I can do is to forgive it, to look at it and recognize that it's innocent, it's blameless, and nothing has gone wrong. And in that way, again, you know, I can evaluate myself and feel loved, believe that God can love me. Wow. I'm going to start reading that paragraph again. You then have two conflicting evaluations of yourself in your mind, and they cannot both be true. You do not yet realize how completely different these evaluations are, because you do not understand how lofty the Holy Spirit's perception of you really is. He is not deceived by anything you do, because he never forgets what you are. See, there's another clue right there. Don't be deceived by what people do. Just remember who they are. The ego is deceived by everything you do, especially when you respond to the Holy Spirit, because at such times its confusion increases. The ego is therefore particularly likely to attack you when you react lovingly, because it has evaluated you as unloving and you are going against its judgment. The ego will attack your motives as soon as they become clearly out of accord with its perception of you. This is when it will shift abruptly from suspiciousness to viciousness, since its uncertainty is increased. And that's text chapter 9, section 7. Wow. So there's the whole dynamics of the ego. I think that actually is what mm-hmm. that section is about.
Yeah, we just need to, you know, be alert to what's going on in our minds, so we're not blindsided when the ego says, "Okay, you're having too much peace here. My fake identity is you know, appears to be threatened." But as he points out, it's like, well, there's nothing really there. You know, it's like nothing real can be threatened.
Yeah. Yeah, and then that reminds me of today's lesson right there. You know, I rule my mind, and I'm the one who makes the decision about what I perceive here and what I don't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how long have I been pretending I don't? How long have I been pretending to myself that some force outside of me is in charge and something, you know, something is making me do things, and, you know, these thoughts just come into my mind and I have to believe them because they're mine. You know, I mean, that's that's really, you know, what's going on here. Is, you know, we're compelled by this insane master to act and react in a certain way. And, you know, when we take charge and say, no, I choose peace, I choose love, I choose innocence, I choose forgiveness, you know, believe me, you know, I've mentioned before that story in the Carol House book about Bill Thetford, and somebody called him up and they were going on about how angry they were at this person and, you know, what this person had done that was just so egregious. And I think Bill said something to the effect of, well, can you just forgive that? And the person was like, no, because this is this. And he said, well, you'll be happier if you do. And, I mean, that's really it.
So when someone appears to be doing something egregious, you agree just for a moment to let it go, right?
Let it go. That's right. Oh, my God. You got to write a book. Anyway.
A third one? Yeah, we're good.
Yeah. Okay, you want to read on?
Sure. So Ken comments on that wonderful passage that it reminds us to be, you know, alert, but in a very gently vigilant way. He says, and since we all identify with the ego, otherwise we would not believe we are here in the world, then we also identify with the ego's vicious attraction to guilt and its choice of messengers of fear to protect us from the death of our thought system and ourselves. So again, we are being encouraged by Jesus not to be afraid of the Holy Spirit's messengers of love and forgiveness, because salvation will come through them and not the messengers of hate. And then quoting from chapter 19 again, we see, theirs are the messages of safety, for they see the world as kind. Ken comments again, they are kind because they do not see attack, and they do not see attack because there is no guilt in their minds to project. Whether someone is acting in the way the world calls loving or hateful, the Holy Spirit's messengers bring back messages of love or calls for love. I kind of see that as you know, if you imagine a feedback diagram, and the world is, you know, apparently sending stuff to us, but it's really coming from our mind and coming back repackaged in a way that we think is outside of ourselves, in terms of other people's behaviors and the world's experiences and so forth. But it's really just a feedback mechanism. And the choice of interpretation comes from this two-position switch in the mind that says ego or Holy Spirit. And what's in the ego position, it's always about the little self that it made up that is always threatened and never at peace. And the Holy Spirit's interpretation setting, it's translation, because it's not misinterpreting anything, just sees it, like Ken says, everything is either a message of love or a call for love. He goes on, consequently, there is no threat and no danger. Knowing we are invulnerable, we are defenseless and thus totally kind. And it is this kindness that we, coming without defenses, cannot but perceive in the world around us. The state of defenselessness summarized in this way in the Manual for Teachers. And this is from section 4 in the manual. God's teachers have learned how to be simple. They have no dreams that need defense against the truth. They do not try to make themselves. Their joy comes from their understanding who created them. And does what God created need defense? No one can become an advanced teacher of God until he fully understands that defenses are but foolish guardians of mad illusions. The more grotesque the dream, the fiercer and more powerful its defenses seem to be. Yet when the teacher of God finally agrees to pass them, he finds that nothing was there. Slowly at first he lets himself be undeceived. But he learns faster as his trust increases. It is not danger that comes when defenses are laid down. It is safety. It is peace. It is joy. And it is gone. Wow. And, of course, he's talking about the defenses in the mind, since what we talk about here on these conversations and, of course, Miracles talks only about is the mind. And then Ken's commentary wrapping up that paragraph is, this shift from the ego's fear, the top line in chart A, which we won't go to because it's visual, to the Holy Spirit's love and forgiveness, viciousness, defensiveness, to kind defenselessness, the bottom line of chart A, is what constitutes the miracle. So basically, that's the shift from vicious defensiveness to kind defenselessness.
Yeah, that is just gorgeous. It's amazing. And, how many times I read this manual for teachers, and it never affected me, this God's teachers have learned how to be simple. You know, that's what I'm going through life every day, thinking this is simple. This is simple. It's not hard. There's no complexity to it. I don't have to come up with a reason for forgiveness. I don't have to come up with any kind of a justification for love. I don't have to do anything. All I have to do is just return what comes to me with love, because it's all love. A call for love is love. Love is the call for love. It's love calling to itself. That's all that's happening here, is love is calling to itself. And so, I was reading that from text chapter 4, section 6, where Jesus is talking about that the only thing that we have, that we do or that is any function of ours at all, really, if we want to be healers, if we want to be whole, is to extend love.
Exactly.
In whatever situation, extend love. And,
yep.
You know, that, I mean, that's, excuse me, doesn't matter, you know, how it comes to us. How we respond to it is the important thing. And I'm just swallowed some spit the wrong way.
what
did you read?
Catch your breath. Is that good?
That's good. Please.
Okay. So Ken continues, no matter what your eyes have seen or what the world tells you is reality, you no longer see fear. Among the most extreme examples of this are people who had been prisoners in Nazi death camps in World War II and were able to go through that experience virtually without fear. They had sent out messengers of love. It is the extreme example, just as it was the extreme example of Jesus, that demonstrates the principle of forgiveness. And there's several examples that we could talk about. Maybe we could revisit that next week. The same idea can be seen in the circumstances of our daily lives. For instance, consider a situation in which someone is telling you about some serious problems and you sense that this other person is in a state of despair. You begin to become afraid for that person and feel the despair. What has happened is that you have sent out the messengers of fear, and therefore that is what you're perceiving, which does not mean that you as an individual are responsible for the other person's despair or fear, but it does mean that you are responsible for your perception and reaction to it. In other words, you would not be upset if you had not first wanted to be upset. And this wish is born of the need to see problems outside yourself as a smokescreen to conceal the problem of your guilt that you believe is truly there. What actually happens is that you first make a decision to be separated from Jesus or the Holy Spirit, the way of protecting your individuality from their love, a shadow of the original decision to be separate from God. Next comes the judgment of sin and guilt, which gives rise to the aforementioned need to project guilt onto another, so as to keep the individuality but not the sin. And this translates in this situation into your feelings of despair, but not from your having separated from love, but rather from the sinful person's having done so.
Wow. That's pretty convoluted.
Well, that's because the ego is convoluted.
That's
amazing.
It
just keeps up making one lie after another to try to cover its tracks, and it never works, of course, because, you know, the bloodhound scent always leads back to the misunderstanding thought system. But then when we use Holy Spirit's vision, we see that there's nothing there and it's all completely forgivable because the unconscious guilt was also unfounded guilt. And it wasn't based on anything real, and being unfounded and real, it can be dismissed. And that's the whole basis for any kind of legitimate forgiveness, is not to make the error real first, but to see that there was no sin, and choose to see our brother's innocence, and then we don't have to be concerned about whether or not we see a body. We just say, okay, would I rather see this person innocent, and then that vision of kindness then informs everything that we think about everyone at some point.
Wow. Yeah, and it just never occurred to me as you were reading this that the real problem is this belief that I can be separated from love, the belief
right.
that I can be separated from God, and that, you know, that's, you know, the reason that, you know, I judge myself, I judge the world, I judge everything as being sinful, because of that big mistake. And, just to recognize that that there was no mistake, that none of this actually happened, and that, you know, you read a book about, you know, somebody, our time is up. The characters in the book are not responsible for the lines. The nothing is really happened here. It's just a story.
And so we put our hands together and say, no mistake, no mistake.
No mistake, that's right. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls.
Likewise, Lynn.
I appreciate being with you. And
Look forward to talking again next week. If you have a moment, we can also talk about the website afterwards.
Absolutely. And I'm going to let go of the mic and turn it over to Iris. And I'm going to run in and turn this recording off, and I'll be right back with you. Iris, this mic is all yours.
Had the lessons work through us kind of this